And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Mark Alpert. Mark, is there anything that you would say is the most frustrating aspect of what we don't know yet?
I guess the frustrating aspect is that we need more data. We need more information from experiments. You know, in physics is really in some way a victim of its own success. We've discovered so much great stuff, but that now to discover more, we have to build enormous facilities, like an $8 billion particle collider. And that's hard to do. That's hard to convince governments to foot the bill for that. I think that's one of the most frustrating things.
Absolutely. And will we get it? And what will get us the answers that we're looking for?
I'm a strong believer in looking to the sky for answers. Rather than building another huge particle collider, let's look more carefully at things that we know are out there, like the cosmic microwave background radiation, like the distribution of galaxies. I think if we look at these things, we might get a much better clue about what dark energy is and what dark matter is. The fact is we need a clue, and I think the clues are going to come from the sky.
And they say the universe is about 14 billion years old, our universe. Why didn't they come up with a number of 15 billion? Well, I mean,
fantastic question. You know, that number has been refined to be 13.8 billion years. And it's one of the glorious successes of physics. By looking at this thing called the cosmic microwave background radiation, which is basically, it was the moment when the universe became transparent. Before, in the very first few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang, the universe was so chock full of energy that light was just bouncing around from one charged particle to another. But there was this magic moment that happened 380,000 years after the Big Bang when the electrons suddenly, there was not as much energy, and so the electrons were able to combine with the protons and form neutral hydrogen atoms, and suddenly the universe became transparent and light was able to go in straight lines. And we can still see that light today. 13.8 billion years later. And by looking really, really carefully and examining that light, we can learn so much, not only about the age of the universe, but the shape of the universe, whether it's infinite or not. And we could learn, you know, maybe more about how the universe was created.
When we finally get the James Webb telescope up there, probably in a couple months, what will that show us that we don't know today?
Yeah, great question. The James Webb is designed to look at frequencies that are more toward the infrared. And basically, this will light up a portion of the universe called the dark ages of the universe. Basically, the first billion years of the universe before, while the first stars and galaxies were forming.
Wow.
That's the fascinating period, because the first stars that formed were these enormous monsters that just blew up real fast, but in their explosions then seeded the rest of the universe with all sorts of elements and also created the first black holes, which may have formed the cores of the first galaxies. So the Webb telescope will be fascinating for illuminating the dark age of the universe.
In theory, could we get back to the point to see right before the first light that it even popped up?
Well, that's a tough one. That's a tough one. We can look back as far as that moment when I mentioned 380,000 years after the Big Bang. But before that, the universe was just this soup, a high energy soup of light and particles. And so to go back farther, we're going to have to figure out more of the laws of physics and say, okay, maybe we can't see directly what happened back there, but we can look at things like, for example, scientists right now are looking at the polarization of the light that from that cosmic microwave background radiation. That will reveal the ripples that went through the early universe. Maybe they were gravitational waves. And if we could see a certain type of polarization in that light, that might really nail down theories about inflation and how the universe actually started.
Let's go to Bakersfield, California. Rick's with us to get us started. Hi, Rick. Go ahead.
How you doing?
Great.
Thanks for taking the call.
Thank you.
You mentioned earlier that you really don't buy into the creationist theories, you know. But when you look at everything around us, everything, you know, in nature works in harmony. It all is balanced. It, you know, one thing makes another thing work. And how is that possible if there is no intervention?
Or order or something like that. It's a beautiful puzzle that just is perfectly laid out, Mark.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, so the question is, did it require a supernatural intervention in order to create it? And I would argue no, because, you know, the Earth, life has been on Earth. You know, life started really pretty early on Earth, within the first couple of billion years of its existence. And so you're talking about billions of years of trial and error where, you know, in order to create that order, there was a lot of disorder. I mean, right, the planet has gone through ages of climate disruption, and the life forms that were able to survive all of those disruptions had to be perfectly harmonious in order to exist. So I could say the fact that everything is so harmonious is a sign that, you know, it wasn't always so harmonious, that things had to evolve to this level. But I agree with you. I mean, you know, it's two ways of looking at it, and you have to. Everyone, I think, has to look at the evidence for themselves and make their decision on that.
Arian, what are the odds with evolution, let's say, of having a male and female human pop up at around the same time so that they could breed and, you know, off we go?
Well, there were males and females in animals way before humans, obviously. I mean, they went all the way back. And but they've changed tremendously. I mean, that is one of the most active areas of evolution because, you know, the sexual selection is, you see it in every single species, you know, where, you know, sometimes the females are deciding to mate with males that have more colorful feathers, for example. Every species has developed incredibly complex mating dances and the reason for that is because mating is the key to propagation, right? Only the animals that only had the best and mating strategies were the only ones to survive and hand down those qualities to their descendants. So in a way, to me, that's another evidence of natural selection at work.
First time caller, we have Lonnie's with us in the state of Washington, where I'll be in 3 weeks at a live show. Hey, Lonnie, go ahead.
Hello, George. Hello, Mark.
Hi.
Hello, I've got a question for you, Mark. In my perspective, and the way I can say it the best I can, is we were born out of a womb. We came out and saw light when we were born, all right? Now, then those who have had NDE experiences say they saw light when they went out of life. So we were born into life, seeing light, and then we were, so to say, those who have had experiences, go out seeing light. Do you have any perspective of any opinion on that?
Oh, I think that's a fascinating subject. I mean, the idea of consciousness, the idea that I can be aware of what I'm doing right now while I'm answering this question, to me, that's one of the great gifts of our lives. And it's an open question now. How much do the animals share of consciousness? You know, at what point in evolution did consciousness really spring into existence? I mean, we obviously have it a lot more than the animals do, right? I mean, an animal never worries about its future or has regrets about the past, and yet we do. And to me, it's a wonderful open question, you know, where did this thing come from, and where in the brain does it reside? If you cut certain circuits in the brain, will, you know, people lose some of their consciousness, right? So there must be some mechanism for it in the brain. But, you know, scientists are still far, far away from figuring that one out.
It's one of the greatest questions of mankind, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I think it's probably the hardest question.
Mike in Denver, take it away, Michael. Good to have you.
Good morning, George. Thank you so much for taking my call. And Mark Alpert, thank you so much for your research and your work with Scientific American. It really means a lot to myself as a younger person, a millennial, so thank you. And I just had a comment and a question for you tonight. So, Mark, you wrote a really interesting book called The Coming Storm, which, you know, it's really a cautionary tale. It warns about the consequences of ignoring, you know, the scientific findings you don't like. And, you know, it also covered the threats to free speech that, you know, for example, former President Trump experienced with this the censorship of his Twitter account. And, you know, what this could essentially turn America into if this kind of thing continues. And, you know, my question around this, I was wondering, because I was wanting to essentially ask you, what real-world implications from that book do you think could apply to, you know, actual real-world situations?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, yeah, I am concerned about free speech, but also, you know, in that book I talk about, you know, the problems of climate change, because the book starts with a description of New York being hit by yet another superstorm. And I hate to tell you this, but just in the past few days, we basically had another storm here that paralyzed New York City, and it showed that we have not done enough to make ourselves resilient for that. And maybe it'll serve as a wake-up call, like, the world is getting warmer. We know that for a fact. And what are we going to do to stop that? And so I think that's one of the things that worries me the most. And why I wrote about it is I want to wake people up and say, you know, come on, you know, let's at least think about this. Let's think about what kind of sacrifices are we willing to make so that our children don't have to live in a world that might become, certain parts of it, uninhabitable. So that was one of the main things I was most interested in when I wrote The Coming Storm.
Mark, how long is the Large Hadron Collider?
It is 27 kilometers in circumference.
My,
I mean, it actually straddles
God.
The border between France and Switzerland. And it has to be that long because you're accelerating the protons. The protons have to travel in a circle. They're guided by superconducting magnets, and they're achieving speeds that are 99.9999% of the speed of light. You have to get them to move that fast in order to create the high-energy collisions so you could see new physics in the debris.
Is it above ground or underground?
It's underground, but not very far underground. And, you know, there was a precursor accelerator called the Tevatron, which was over in the United States, in Fermilab, the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory that's outside of Chicago. And I actually visited that lab when I was doing some research, and I have to tell you, it was an amazing experience. You know, when I went down into the tunnel, and it's a circular tunnel, and there's these superconducting magnets that are cooled down by liquid helium, and they told me, okay, we're going to give you an oxygen tank, because, yeah, there's a slight chance the helium could leak, and so you'll have 5 minutes of oxygen so you could run to the nearest exit. And I thought to myself, oh, this thriller I'm going to write about this, it's writing itself.
I love it. Let's go to Canada. Marcel's with us. Hello, Marcel.
Yes. Hello, George and Mark.
Hi.
I was wondering if I could throw out a concept at you, Mark.
Sure.
And I hope I can get this out as succinctly as possible because it has different angles. But the Hindus call this world Maya. The universe is Maya. It's an illusion. It's basically our egos, which separated from source, wanted to live out a separate identity, and it's the material world. So science is trying to grapple with this illusion. Now, you can't use science, per se, to get to reality till you drop the ego, because the ego is what got us here in the first place. So we can do all the science and all the math we want, but till you drop the ego, you'll see that the material world disappears, this universe disappears, and the spiritual world appears, or the highest dimension appears, and is what we are, our true self. So science is, in a way, is studying the illusion, which is not us. It's only a playground for the ego, and I'm just
well. That's fascinating. That's fascinating. I do think that ego can get in the way when scientists do their work. Because, for example, if you've been, you know, working on string theory for 40 years of your life, you really want this theory to work, and you might even ignore certain evidence that's saying no, maybe string theory doesn't work. And, you know, I also agree very strongly with your idea of the universe being an illusion, because that has been backed up, you know, in a lot of speculative hypotheses. Like, for example, time. We experience time as this forward motion, like we're constantly seeing new time. But perhaps that is, some physicists think that might be an illusion, that time might exist all as one dimension and all at once, and it's an emergent property of the universe, and it's only because of our limited observation of the universe that we can only move forward in time, but actually it might exist all at once. And so that's an example of a possible illusion of our universe.
Tim, were you ever a telescope kid?
You mean enjoying telescopes? Yes, definitely. In fact,
me too.
I still do, and I went up to northern Michigan where my in-laws are, and they have a wonderful telescope, and I love sharing it with my kids who are college-age now. And I say, let's look at Jupiter. Let's see those Galilean satellites all strung out in a beautiful line. It's a wonderful thing to share with kids.
Thank you, Mark. Tim in Carson City, Nevada. Hi, Tim. Go ahead.
Hey, George. It's an honor to speak with you again.
Thank you, sir.
I had a couple personal questions I wanted to ask you. Whatever happened to JC?
He's out there somewhere, but who knows? He calls that a whim, but that's a good question.
And also, I've learned a ton over the years from listening to the show, and I wanted to know if you ever kept track of how many people you've interviewed over your career.
Thousands. Literally thousands.
So the broad spectrum of topics that you guys talk about is, you don't find it anywhere else.
Nope, you really don't.
It's amazing. So I kind of have this, it's a theory, a comparison I wanted to get your guesses, response to.
Sure.
From what I understand, the theory of the Big Bang was there was nothing, and then suddenly there was energy that could be measured, because everything's energy. I think there's 9 forms with 2 primary forms of energy. It can't be created or destroyed, but light, you know, matter, everything, so on, is energy. Now, I think of the human body, it's kind of like a universe. We have trillions of souls, and if you hook the human body up to high-tech machinery, they can locate in the portion of the brain where the thought comes from for sadness, or the thought to move my toe.
That's right.
You know, but they can't figure out where the thought originates from. Kind of the ghost in the machine theory. So it seems like every time we have a thought, there's nothing, and then suddenly there's energy that can be measured. It's almost like every thought is a miniature Big Bang.
Well, Mark, how do you explain nothing?
That's a great question, because a lot of physicists say nothing is impossible, that even in vacuum space, even when you think everything is empty, there are these things called virtual particles that are constantly popping in and out of existence. And this sounds, it might sound supernatural to you, but no, this is one of the tenets of quantum theory, that this does exist. We know this happens. And so a lot of scientists say that nothing is not the natural state of the universe. That actually, in order to have something, things have to exist. That the Big Bang in some way was inevitable. That if you leave something nothing around long enough, it will eventually become something, just by these quantum processes, these virtual particles, you know, causing what they call it's technically called inflation. It's a theory that was developed in the 80s to describe why the universe is so incredibly uniform. It's incredibly smooth. And the theory that they developed was that over time, a piece of some kind of what existed before our universe may have suddenly shifted into a different energy state and sort of generated an entirely new universe, because the universe abhors a vacuum. Nothing cannot exist for long. Something has to pop up. And a lot of people think that's one of the corollaries of quantum theory.
Mark, did you ever in your career interview Stephen Hawking when he was alive?
You know, it's so unfortunate, but no, I never did. But when I was in college, one of the first papers I wrote was about one of his theories. And so he was one of my scientific heroes, no question.
We were working on an interview with him where we would have had to have taped it, of course, and then edited it together, because there was a big time gap between questions and when he was able to respond through his machine. But that would have been fantastic.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But, you know, I did get a chance once to interview Carl Sagan, and that was an amazing experience.
He was something else. He was a believer in extraterrestrial life. He wrote the book Contact.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And he was also just a brilliant physicist who knew how to connect with the general public.
Absolutely. Mark, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and take final phone calls with you here on Coast to Coast AM. Mark Alpert, our special guest. Again, his website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Back with your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Open lines begin next hour here on Coast to Coast, so get ready for that. We'll be back in a moment with final calls with Mark Alpert as we talk about physics and space and all these great things. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Mark Alpert with us. Mark, other dimensions, extra dimensions, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's, you know, there is more that we can see that is obviously out there. And extra dimensions might be one of those things. As I mentioned, in string theory, they predict that there are 6 or 7 extra dimensions, but we don't see them because they could be folded up into tiny, tiny manifolds. And so we're moving through them all the time. We just never observe it. So that's one possibility. There's also another possibility that our three-dimensional universe might be embedded in an extra-dimensional universe. And so we are sort of a membrane moving through a larger thing called the bulk. This is another theory that string theorists have developed. It's all possible.
If you could have one question answered by some authority that had the answer, just one question, which would that question be?
It would be what started, what triggered the Big Bang?
Yep.
That would be it.
And I bet they couldn't give us an answer either.
No, right now we don't know the answer, but I'm hopeful that once we figure out the theory of everything and we know quantum gravity, we will have a much better idea how it happened.
I mean, what was before it?
Exactly. And was there a before? It's possible that the universe always existed. And I mean, we could be in an eternal universe. Some scientists have developed this theory of eternal inflation, that there's this thing called the inflationary background from which not only our universe has blossomed, but, you know, an infinite number of universes have blossomed, and it's been going on for all time and will continue for all time. That's a possibility, too.
Are you leaning toward the God theory? I keep coming back to it. I can't get away from it.
Oh, and I don't think you should get away from it. I think in order to be alive, you have to be fascinated by this question. And so am I leading one way or another? I really am at sea. And to tell you the truth, I hope to be at sea for the rest of my life because in some ways I don't want questions to be answered. I love the mystery. I love the excitement of not knowing.
Well, and we may never know. That's the other ironic part about all this.
Right, and I think everyone needs to do their own work and do their own thinking about it and make their own decisions.
Next up, we go east of the Rockies. Joe is with us in Long Island, New York. Joseph, hi.
Yeah, let's figure out dark matter first. But my question deals more with the Earth. You mentioned Mark fine-tuning. But dealing with physics, you know, and I have several examples. So it'll take me a minute. But, all right, now you've got people landing planes on aircraft carriers. That seems to be an estimation. You've got volcanoes that explode at a certain force and magnitude. What is that force and magnitude? You've got earthquakes that measure on a Richter scale, but how do you interpret a Richter scale? And something that I think is relevant to me is if you're a swimmer in an ocean with currents or higher waves going out, how do you estimate that this is not going to be actually dangerous or that you're going to get pulled out and not be able to get in? It's really just estimation to me rather than fine-tuning.
Well, you know, that is a key issue. When dealing with any kind of science, you have to figure what are the units that we are using to measure the phenomenon that we are studying. And, you know, you mentioned several very interesting, you know, aerodynamics, fluid dynamics. These are all, you know, if you do a thorough study of it, you'll see that, you know, scientists have been working on this stuff for decades and have developed some pretty good theories. But they're like, you know, there are still great mysteries. Like, you know, we talked about the mystery of fundamental physics and consciousness, but there's also fundamental mysteries of turbulence. Scientists still don't really fully understand how turbulence works, the fluid turbulence. And you would think we would know that by now, but they don't. So there are still mysteries out there in all different kinds of science.
Absolutely. Joe, thanks for your call. Appreciate it. Next up, let's go to Steve in Texas. Steven, go ahead.
Hello, George.
Hi, Stevie. How are you?
And Mark. Oh, fine. And Mark.
Hey.
Thank you all for the enlightenment this evening. Hey, George has been talking about this forever, and I have been thinking about it too. And my inspiration came from reading Lynn McTaggart's book, The Field. And I'm going to, I mean, this, and that is, where do we come from? You know, we're like our universe. I'll try not to take too much time, but of course, trying to explain the universe might take more than 2 minutes. but anyway, Lynn McTaggart's theory of the field is somewhat synonymous with, in my opinion, to the God theory. So let's say for the matter of this conversation that it is synonymous. All right. People talk about where we come from, the Big Bang. Well, okay, some people think it's coming from nothing. No. In fact, Mark, you mentioned this a minute ago. I think it came from the sum total of all things, which is the God theory. And if you combine God theory as being the quantum field, is total energy, and it is total information, too. Lynn McTaggart says that there are these wavelengths that are similar to radio waves that carry information from the beginning of time about everything that is. All right, so we're still talking about this God theory. So, all right, now let's take to try and explain an infinite picture. I'm gonna put it in front of us as a fishbowl containing water. That water is depictive of the total of everything. Okay. All right, and if God is thoughts is in there, and God is conscious, I believe we came from His a thought in God's consciousness. All right, now to describe this so that we can see it, take a drop of concentrated ink and drop it right anywhere inside this globe of water, which is depictive of, now see, it's everything, total of everything, including every dimension that there always is. So this is our universe that was exploded out of it by disturbance in the quantum field, and it's represented by an ink dot that just dropped into it. Okay, there's the Big Bang right there. You saw it come into existence as depicted as this drop of ink. Now, when we're talking, that drop of ink is starting to expand, and it will continue to expand until the point to where it loses its energy and is absorbed back into the quantum field. And this process starts all over again and is constantly happening while we're talking. There's thoughts and universes popping up in different continually and being absorbed back into the quantum field.
Well, you know, it's fascinating that you mentioned the drop of water, because when you're talking about diffusion there, you're talking about the laws of thermodynamics. And a lot of scientists do believe that those laws will be a key to discovering the theory of everything. I also liked your idea of where things come from, because, you know, we've been talking a lot about the Big Bang, but maybe we should be talking more about where did the laws of physics come from? I mean, the laws of physics predict some kind of Big Bang, but where did the laws themselves come from? Did they arise inevitably from certain symmetries of our universe, or were they there somehow before the universe even existed? To me, that's really one of the most fascinating questions.
Now, Mark, when you were a little boy, were you a believer in the God concept?
Well, sure. You know, I grew up with the idea of God, yes. I don't know if I could say I was a very religious believer, but this idea was always out there, and it always fascinated me. I remember when I was a little kid, I used to imagine God not as a person, but as the sun. And I used to imagine a giant sun with, you know, with legs and arms, you know, looking down through the sky. I guess maybe that explains part of my fascination with this, you know, because I think most people sort of either believe in God wholeheartedly without examining it very much, and a lot of scientists in particular just dismiss the notion out of hand and says, oh, that's ridiculous, there's no proof for it whatsoever, it's silly to even entertain the concept. And for me, I feel like I'm in the middle. I'm willing to take whatever I see is true and make my own conclusions on it.
Is God an excuse for people who can't come up with an answer?
Well, that seems, you know, a lot of people do have this idea like, oh, God is an easy explanation for something that you're not willing to take the time to really study and understand. And so that's part of the reason why I don't like creationism and the intelligent design, because there is a really good explanation for evolution, and there's been so much fantastic study of it. And to simply say, oh, you know, God created all the species, well, I think that's an easy explanation. Look a little harder, and you'll see that you know, you could explain it using this amazing process that's been going on Earth for billions of years. But, you know, I can't be so dismissive when it comes to the Big Bang, because we just don't know how it started. We don't know how the laws of the universe arose. That's where I have the mystery for me.
My mother always used to say, still does, she's 92, that God is always was, always will be. And I keep telling her, Mom, I need more than that.
really interesting. You know, the idea of the eternal God, you know, Thomas Aquinas had that, you know, that God has to be eternal because nothing could have created it. And some people think maybe that's true of the universe as well.
Let's go to Joe in Lansing, Michigan. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thanks.
Hey, I'm with George Norrie. Hey, if you want a scientist that's got the God question kind of down with Darwinian logic, please have on Dr. David Sloan Wilson. He wrote the Darwin's Cathedral. I don't know if you've heard of him or not.
Okay, yeah, we'll check into it.
Please have him on. Now, my question, and like I asked this question when Art Bell was on back in the day, it's about time travel and the movement of the sun around the around the galaxy. We're moving like 500,000 miles an hour around the galaxy. And time travel, like if we were to time travel even a few hundred years, like Star Trek, they went back to save the whales. You had Marty McFly go back. How does physics explain this kind of distance and time travel? Is it wormholes? Is it something else? What does modern physics say about time travel?
Oh, yeah, that's a
good question.
You know, time travel is one of these things I love talking about. You know, time travel to the future, we know it exists because we know by the theory of general relativity that if you're accelerating at, you know, relative, like if I take off in a rocket and I leave Earth and I accelerate at a high rate, say close to the speed of light, and then I return to Earth, then my time scale is going to be different. I will come back to the Earth maybe only a year older, and 100 years may have passed on Earth. And so in essence, I have traveled to the future, and we know this is physically possible. And in fact, we see evidence of it in our satellites now, which their clocks are running. They're outside of Earth's gravity well, and so a little bit outside of it, and their clocks are traveling at a slightly different rate than ours. Now, the big question, though, is time travel to the past even possible? Because that's something that we don't see predicted at all in our current physics. And some scientists have proposed conjectures saying it can't possibly be true. But those things have not been proved one way or the other. So in summary, time travel to the future, definitely possible. Time travel to the past, it looks like it's forbidden, but we don't know for sure.
Let's go to Bristol, Wisconsin. The BA is with us. Hello, BA. Welcome.
Good evening, fellas.
Hi.
George, thank you so much for introducing me to your guest's perspective.
Oh, you're welcome.
I'm going to call the book that I write about him, The Existential Physicist.
I like that.
Good.
Good title.
Well, the intellectual stimulation is off the rails. It might be a little Shiraz, but first, I want to appreciate his point of view and his perspective, how he, like, walks in everybody's shoes around the whole circle. I want to say that I'm a journalist and a scientist and a writer and an artist, a physical artist. So the stuff he was talking about, negative space, kind of related it to art. And the one caller that was talking about putting ink in water and watching it spread, that struck me. But my thing is the never-ending story.
And what is that never-ending story?
Well, in the never-ending story, and I think that your guests can appreciate it. Hi, Mark.
Hey.
He has kids. But I remember, you know, thinking about all these perspectives and investigating, you know, what I was raised with and what I've come to know, you know, to examine things and investigate things. The journalist in me, but there's a scene in the movie where the princess is holding a grain of sand in her hand, and it recreates everything that had been lost or melted or blown away.
I think it turned into like the universe, and everything just came out of that sand. But interesting.
Well, that's kind of similar to the theory of inflation, which basically said that a tiny amount of space expanded and became our entire universe.
Mark, we've got a minute left. First of all, tell folks where they can get your book, give out your website, and then I have a final quick question for you.
Yeah, sure. You can see descriptions of all my books on my website, and that is www.com. markalpert.com. It's spelled markalpert.com.
What will get us the answers that we've been all talking about tonight with these questions?
More exploration of the universe, more telescopes, more study of the cosmic microwave background radiation, more study of the distribution of galaxies. I believe that will give us the answers.
Will it be technology that does it?
We will need technology because a lot of these telescopes have to be put into space. There's this great proposal called LISA, which is the Laser Interferometry Space Antenna, and this thing would be an amazing thing for discovering gravitational waves from the beginning of creation, and this is going to need really high tech in order to put it up in space, but it might be done by the 2030s.
Mark, thanks for being on the program. Really appreciate it. Good luck with everything you do. Up next, Open Lines.